Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
That's right. Come on back and help WHFR celebrate Dearborn's 34th Annual Homecoming Festival, August 2nd, 3rd, and 4th in West Dearborn. At Ford Field Park, 22051 Cherry Hill. Join us for all the fun, including live music, amazing food, and all the fun rides. Also, don't forget to stop on over at our WHFR tent, located across from the carnival area, and say hi, or maybe just check out our massive CD sale, where all of our CDs are just $1. WHFR will be there every day from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. Remember, that's August 2nd, 3rd, and 4th at Ford Field Park, 22051 Cherry Hill in West Dearborn. Thanks for tuning in to the station that's making waves.
Oh yeah, it's your boy T-Roy, Rep Your City 247 official, and you are listening to 89.3 FM, the station making waves, and I host the Block Party every Friday, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., straight Michigan music, so make sure you tune in, listen to the boy on the radio, doing it in, right here at Henry Ford Community College, WHFR Dearborn, nothing but the best, all independent music, two straight hours, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., because why? Because we got people, and we got music, WHFR Dearborn.
Hey, Dad, how do you throw a curveball? How do you build a fort? How do refrigerators run? How do fish learn how to swim?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
How high can you jump?
But you don't have to know every answer.
How many phone numbers are there?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
How do cell phones work?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
What's electricity?
They just need you.
What's the moon made of?
For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Amy Milan from STARS, and you're listening to WHFR 89.3 in Dearborn, Michigan, the station making waves.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Thank you for listening to Philosophy Talk's free weekly download.
You can do your part for intelligent, reflective media by making a tax-deductible contribution to Philosophy Talk.
And we really do rely on your support. Any contribution, big or small, will help us stay on the air and online.
And donating is really very simple. Just visit our website at philosophytalk.org and click on the Donate link.
Thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk, and
thank you for thinking.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Stanford University campus. This program is part of the Stanford Continuing Study Series, The Art of Living.
Our thinking originates on the underside of the quad at Philosopher's Corner. That's where Ken and I teach philosophy.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, ancient wisdom for modern times.
Specifically, the wisdom of the ancient Greeks, in particular, Plato and Aristotle.
Now, there are other wise and ancient philosophers like Confucius, but today our focus is on the Greeks.
Now, you might wonder why. Most Greeks thought the earth was flat, slavery was okay, and women were second-class people. Plato rose above some of that, but he thought that democracy sucked, poetry and drama were bad things, and that freedom of speech was a joke. He even thought that philosophers, of all people, should be kings. So, Ken, where's the wisdom in all that?
Well, no doubt about it, John. The Greeks got lots of things wrong, but they also got a lot right. And we moderns would do well to appreciate and adopt some of their wisdom especially their wisdom about their ethical wisdom.
I don't suppose you mean about slavery and women.
No, I mean their wisdom about virtue and vice. The Greeks had a very profound understanding, very profound, of the nature of human virtue and of human vice. Somewhere along the line, modern philosophy sort of lost track of that understanding.
Well, that's because modern ethical theory followed in the footsteps of Kant, Bentham, and Mill. They're more focused on the right than on the good.
The right versus the good. Now, that's a good distinction, but I think you need to explain that distinction.
Well, when the Greeks thought about ethics, what they had in mind was the nature of a good or a well-lived human life. Their topic was the good. Their basic ethical question, what does it take for a human being to live well and thrive?
And modern philosophers?
Well, their basic ethical question is, what are the moral rules that govern our interactions with others? The Greeks were far less concerned with rules than the moderns. They were more concerned with the cultivation of virtues like courage, honor, moderation, and the like.
And, you know, with our focus on rules, we've lost something that the Greeks understood. And I actually think, John, that a lot of our problems are due to an excess of vice and a shortage of virtue.
Well, you know, maybe, could be, but let's give modernism its due. Mill, for example, had the great idea that we should all be free to do whatever we want as long as we don't hurt others. That's plausible. Mandeville pointed out that greed may be a private vice, but it's a public virtue. Greedy people do big things. They create jobs. Then they die and give their money to found universities.
You can add to your pantheon the Adam Smith, John. He thought that if we each pursue our own desires, the market's invisible hand will ensure the best result for all. It sounds like you agree with this. You sound like Gordon Gekko. Greed is good. Is that what you think?
Well, I haven't swallowed the whole glass of Kool-Aid, but let's admit it. The system has worked well for the United States. Lots of freedom, not a lot of virtue, lots of greed, lots of wealth. Maybe Plato and Aristotle were wrong and Gordon Gekko had it right.
I just don't know. I look at our situation differently. Look, if you bungee jump off a cliff and you don't realize that your cord is torn, you're going to feel quite exhilarated. You think you're well off. But you're not. You're cruising for a serious bruising, dude. That's the position modern society is in.
Well, Mr. Smiley Face, why don't you tell me a little more?
Consumerism and greed, what the Greeks would think of as appetites run wild, appetites run amok. They've led us into a series of financial debacles and have propelled us into a huge ecological crisis. And only our willful ignorance about the future, what the Greeks would call hubris, can make us feel good about the situation of modernity.
So kind of what you're telling me is if we just take on the ancient Greek virtues of moderation and civic-mindedness, we might actually be able to ameliorate our ecological disaster?
You sound skeptical. But I know you. I know that in your moderate and civic-minded heart of hearts, some little part of you agrees with me. Come on, admit it.
Oh, well, deep down, I really wish it were true, and it might help a little, but there are some pretty basic problems. Our whole economy is based on consumers wanting a lot and greedy corporations getting rich, satisfying those wants. If we don't keep stoking this fire, we have depression, poverty, no money left for things like research on solar energy.
So you're telling me that private virtue and moderation might make for public disaster, is that it?
Suppose everyone was like me and they were happy having a 20-year-old car. Detroit would go broke. The whole system would break down. Consumerism makes our world go around. You couldn't have anything like America if our economy was fueled by the wants and needs of, say, virtuous monks and nuns.
See, John, you know, I see your point. There are problems, but I'm not willing to give up just yet. And to help us see that it can be done, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to find some modern people applying ancient wisdom to their own lives. She files this report.
On a recent Saturday, members of a philosophy club at UC Riverside packed their tents and sleeping bags and headed into the desert. There, they joined dozens of amateur astronomers, tourists, and scientists for a star party. For hours, they stared at the same night sky that had puzzled ancient philosophers.
I feel so small.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the most important thing, is that it kind of reminds you just how small and insignificant we really are.
Seniors Joshua Bunce and Marcella Beau came out to Mojave National Preserve for some of the darkest skies in the country. Low in the horizon, you can see the glow of Las Vegas many miles away. You can see constellations, shooting stars, even the Milky Way.
It's awesome, especially Saturn. Saturn's really cool.
Wow.
I mean, it just looks like something out of like an old science fiction movie. It's just this glowing, bright white orb with a little ring around it, actually a big ring.
The ancients believed the Earth was the center of a finite universe, but not Epicurus. He believed the universe is infinite and that we're all made up of atoms and that we have no immaterial souls. And that got senior Sarah Overholt's thinking about the relationship between science and philosophy and the things we've learned since Epicurus's time.
He had like a lot of arguments about how you could like to prove that the sun was the size that we saw it was. And of course, now we know that's wrong. So it is interesting. It's just one of those points where you realize that as science progressed, a lot of philosophy has also changed.
We realize that we're not the center of the universe, right? And sometimes science can kind of tell us otherwise, right? That because we have science, we can know everything, but we always have to remember that we're just, you know, small. We're small. We're human beings, and, you know, we have a very limited perspective on things, you know?
These are exactly the kinds of questions Christopher Phillips found himself thinking about back in 1996. So he started a small group that met regularly at a coffee house in Montclair, New Jersey. He called it Socrates Cafe. They'd sit around questioning everything. No discussion was off limits.
It can be a typical one, from ones that Socrates investigated to like, what is justice? You know, what is virtue? What is moderation? Or it can be something like, how does a kind, intelligent person gets stuck in a lousy job.
Soon, Socrates Cafe took off. Philip started hearing from folks in far-flung places.
I started getting letters from people in prison, people in nursing homes, people in elementary school, junior high school, say, we can't come there. It's too, you know, so can you come to where we are and show us how to do this ourselves?
Now, there are upwards of 600 groups across the United States and abroad. The beauty of the group is that it brings the Socratic method to life. When Phillips discusses Socrates, it's like he's talking about a lost friend or a mentor he deeply respects.
He helped people bring out ideas that they didn't even know that they harbored within them. I mean, that is genius. You know, you have a certain idea of what you think when you're left to your own devices. It's when you engage in a certain methodical inquiry with other people that inspires them to, in an unsettling and exhilarating sort of discovery, to tease out ideas that they didn't even know they had.
Philip sees this kind of inquiry as vital to our modern lives. At a time when proselytizing and partisanship seem to have reached new heights, Phillips believes we should be surrounding ourselves with people who challenge us.
I do not believe you can have a vibrant democracy if we don't have that operating premise that I could be wrong.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry, along with my fellow philosopher at Stanford, Ken Taylor, and we're coming to you from the Stanford campus, part of the continuing studies series, The Art of Living.
Our guest today is a professor of politics from Princeton University. She's author of Eco-Republic, What the Ancients Can Teach Us About Ethics, Virtue, and Sustainable Living. Please join us in welcoming Melissa Lane.
Melissa, Plato and Aristotle are very ancient philosophers. I mean, they're dead. They've been dead a long time. The ecological crisis is right now. It's upon us. How do these two temporally such distant topics get joined in your mind and in your wonderful book that Ken will hold up?
Thank you. It was actually started in a kind of uncanny experience. On the one hand, I started to hear people talk about the financial crisis, the ecological crisis, using these words that were Greek words. So they said the problem is hubris and greed and heedlessness and stupidity, which are exactly the inverse of Plato's virtues. Those are the Greek vices. And so then I started to wonder, well, maybe some of the Greek solutions could actually be relevant. And I started to hear people, business leaders, policymakers starting to talk about this too. So starting to think, maybe if we think about doing the right thing as the smart thing to do, not just what we should do, and maybe thinking about it in the big picture of what's really good, maybe that could be the right path.
Now, there's a tradition of philosophers having the ear of great leaders. Aristotle was the teacher of Alexander the Great. Now you, Melissa, have taught Princes William and Harry and been a close advisor to the president of Costa Rica. So what piece of ancient philosophical wisdom did you share with these rulers?
Actually, it was challenging because I think the deepest political insight is Plato's idea that the people you want as rulers have to be reluctant. But that's kind of a hard thing to say to an elected politician or princes who are born to the royal purple. But I think the idea underlying that, and I think actually all these people that I had the privilege of working with understood this, is that the point of rulers isn't to benefit themselves. It's to benefit those that they rule. It has to be, and that's what it really means to be reluctant. You're reluctant because you're not in it for yourself. You're in it to serve others.
You're not in it for the sheer joy of the power, for the sheer, I did that, for the sheer ego stroke?
If you are, you're setting up yourself and others for a fall.
But we admire people who are ambitious. We admire people who strive, who want more. Even if they don't want more for somebody else, we admire people who want more. Are we wrong by the Greek lights to admire people who want more?
Well, it depends what you mean by want more. So if what you want is more stuff, more goods, more objects,
more that's fame, what they, more
well,
wealth.
Okay, so that's what they called pleonexia. That's wanting to have more, and that's a political danger. But the Greek society was very competitive, and people were seeking fame and admiration. But even then, if we remember the Roman example of every emperor or general who had a triumph, he had to have a slave wandering behind him to say, remember, you are mortal.
Well, you know, in philosophy departments and other departments, there's often said, well, we have a power struggle every few years, and the loser gets to be chairman.
And I lost that for 6 years in a row. Yeah.
And see what a good ruler you were.
And if we had someone in our department that showed the ambition of Hillary Clinton or Obama or John McCain to be chairman, we'd be very suspicious of them. But we do seem to accept that in our leaders.
Well, I think this is where I think, as I said, when you think about this with elected politicians, obviously in an elected system, people have to put themselves forward. So in that sense, mm-hmm. they have to have some of that ambition. But I think if they don't have also a kind of inner self-awareness and self-restraint and knowledge of why they want to do it and what they want to do with it, that's, otherwise then that can be really dangerous.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Stanford campus, where we're looking at ancient wisdom for modern times. Our guest is Melissa Lane from Princeton University.
In the next segment, we're going to consider ancient Greek insights and how they might help us with modern problems.
Greeks, greed, and a world in need, along with questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Melissa Lane from Princeton University. We're talking about ancient wisdom for modern times.
What does the world need? More consumers? More greed? More taxes? More humility? Give us your opinion. Join the discussion by stepping up to one of the microphones at either side of the stage.
So, Melissa, as John was saying in the opening, modern economics is arguably based on, well, you might call it a simple-minded picture of human psychology. People are rational maximizers of wants and desires. They have these desires. They want to satisfy these desires. They want to satisfy them to the highest degree. Reading your book, you think the Greeks had a more subtle, richer, more adequate picture of the human mind. How do you think their insights might be helpful to us in the modern era?
So modern psychology and economics tend to take desires as given. We start with the desires and then we figure out how to satisfy them. And I think what all the Greek philosophers did was to say, you know, are those desires really going to be good for you? Are they really going to satisfy you? So let's even take the most extreme case. So Epicurus, who said that the point of life is to pursue pleasure, that sounds like he might fit right into that modern economic framework. But actually, he ended up saying, well, wait, if you really think about it, if you're pursuing constant new things to drink or eat or whatever, that's actually going to make you feel insecure. You might not get what you thought you wanted. It might run out. Somebody else might get more than you. You're not actually going to find that pleasurable.
So mm-hmm. I call this modern picture of desires simple. I'm not quite sure it's so simple. But there is a strand in sort of modern thinking. John's favorite philosopher, Hume, says, reason is and ought to be nothing but the slave to the passions. So what's the role of reason? Calculate how to get the things you want. That's the sole role of reason. Can't tell you what to want, except as a means to some other end, but it can. There are some philosophers who disagree with that. But, I mean, the Greeks did not think of desire that way and reason that way. Did reason have some power to tell you what it's right to desire or something like that? How's that supposed to work?
Yeah, well, again, it's interesting to start with Epicurus, even though I mainly work on Plato, but I think Epicurus is an interesting case here because he thinks, well, actually, even if you thought that reason was the slave of the desire, so it's trying to tell you how to get what you want, even then, if you really think about it, you're going to realize that what it's best, what you actually want, what you're going to enjoy having. So he wanted to say what you enjoy having, that's what's good for you. But even that is going to be really radically different from what you might have thought left to your own devices or just modeling yourself on the behavior of others. And then certainly Plato and Aristotle beefed that up, or they had already beefed that up before Epicurus came along. And they wanted to suggest, well, you have to really ask the question, what's good? You know, what's actually going to constitute the good life? And reason for them could be a guide to tell you that.
I mean, it seems to me that we have some basic needs and probably pretty basic desires. But most of our desires kind of are up for grabs. I mean, what's going to really motivate us? And we see the government now, our government, the California state government and the U.S. government, really trying to influence people's desires. One is the anti-smoking ads. Those are pretty effective, and they really decrease my interest in smoking. Mm. And then the other is the lottery, right? Mm. The California produces these ads that say, hey, this is the greatest thing that'll ever happen to you. You'll become a super trillionaire, although the empirical evidence is these people all come in happy. So we've got those two. Should the government really play a big role in trying to tell people what to desire, kind of counterbalance corporations in that way? And how could we do that in a way that left out the lottery but did more like the smoking?
Yeah, so I have two answers to this question. So, you know, one answer is the sort of idea of nudge. So you try to nudge people in the right direction without necessarily forcing them. That's been developed by the economist Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler. But the other answer is, even if we go back to Mill, who you mentioned in the opening of the program, who says the harm principle, you only stop people from doing what's harmful to them, but then we have to say, what's harm? You know, we have this kind of pre-theoretical sense, we think of, we know what harm is. So we think, oh, well, I'm allowed to not insulate my attic and thereby use much more energy than I need to. Well, maybe that's actually harming people, and we just haven't figured out yet that that should come into that net. So I actually think that even according to impeccable liberal principles, once we start thinking more seriously about what's good, what's harm, we're going to find the state drawing lines in a different place.
But see, here's the thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, here's the big turn in modernity there are many big turns in modernity away from the wisdom of the ancients, right? For one thing, I'm an autonomous, self-governing being. What does that mean? I choose my life, right? I choose my life. I choose what to pursue, all that. I do that without interference from anybody else. The state is not really there to tell me what the good life is. That's not the business of the state. The state is there in a way to keep John from interfering with me and me from interfering with John, because without the state we might. But the main job of the state is to referee our disputes and stay out of the way and let us each do our thing.
Well, again, I think actually when we think about it, we realize that the state always has to be doing some relatively thin, you know, somewhere in the middle between thin and thick job of deciding what the good life is. But because it's been doing it in a certain way for so long, that becomes invisible to us. You know,
well, what
so,
do you mean by that?
Well, so for example, you know, why do we think national security is a good thing? Why do we think that being subject to terrorism is a good thing? I mean, those things, we have to make the judgments that those things are good things. So the state is pursuing good things. And my point about sustainability is that we have to realize that unless we are doing things in a way that we can go on sustaining values over time, then actually we won't be doing our job. So sustainability is a sort of side constraint on the way that we're already operating in politics.
So if I were king of the world for a day and I wanted to solve the ecological crisis, I would kind of be torn between two routes. One is the libertarian route, but real libertarian, not this faux libertarianism we have. Real libertarianism, you pay the costs of what you do. And so we would have a mammoth carbon tax, mm-hmm. right? That's mm-hmm. what a true libertarian would be for, and that mm-hmm. would make a tremendous mm-hmm. difference. The other view is kind of, no, we need a basic change in human soul. We need a religious conversion. We need to worship the earth. There needs to be a movement that sweeps across the earth like Islam and Christianity and Buddhism did at various times. So people just change what they want. Which way would you go? Which way would the Greeks have us go?
So I actually think we need to do both. So no, I know, but no.
You're not ambitious or anything.
But no, but in the sense that, you know, carbon tax, absolutely we need it. But guess what? Taxes have loopholes, they have delays, they have appeals, they have enforcement problems. Actually, any kind of regulation that's ever been passed, you need people with decent wisdom and competency to enforce it. That's what Senator Dodd said right after passing Dodd-Frank. He said, we can pass this legislation, but we can't legislate good people to enforce it. So you need enforcement, and you need the right attitude so that people obey the law rather than trying to evade it.
But reading your book, I get the I mean, there are particular policies that may help us to be more sustainable, but it seemed to me that your fundamental thought is that we need to reimagine what we are as individuals, how we relate to the state, how we relate to one another. You seem to think we need a fundamental reimagining of our lives together. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right, because that's the deeper side of this, is that, well, actually part of having a sustainable society is having a society where people's motivations and the social world they produce are in a stable, harmonious relationship. So that's why Greeks weren't thinking about ecological sustainability, of course, but they were thinking about social and psychological stability. And so my message is that kind of stability has to be at the heart of what we mean by sustainability. It's not all we mean, but it has to be part of what
You're
we
listening
mean.
To Philosophy Talk. Mm-hmm. We're talking about ancient wisdom for modern times with Melissa Lane in front of a live audience at Stanford University. We've got a questioner from that live audience. Well, welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Kumar from Menlo Park. I come from India, and as I grew up, the virtue that was taught and ingrained in us was to live within your means, live with what you have. The less you live with, the better you are. Gita taught that. The ancient wisdom teaches that. Mm. Mahatma Gandhi actually lived like that, and we, as we grew up, we saw that as an example. Mm. And unfortunately, in retrospect, the country followed him and stayed within its means, never progressed anywhere, paid attention to cottage industry and small village things, and we went nowhere. As I grew up, I saw people who were coming here as we became doctors, and we saw that greed, this kind of economy, is what gives you pleasure and happiness, obviously. I moved here, and I've been the happiest person for the last 35, 40 years. So it seems like greed may be a vice in your list of vices, but it seems to be a virtue from every way I can look at when I compare the two economies.
And I want to just pile on for you a little bit, because I want to give you this challenge. This is the great insight of capitalism, and capitalism, the huge watershed event in the history of humanity, has produced so much more material well-being and prosperity around the world than anything that came before it. And moreover, we don't know how to run an economy that doesn't have constant growth, that doesn't have more and more desires being satisfied. So what do you want to do, go back to the ancient Greek standard of living?
So this is a great question, and thank you for raising that. It's a deep challenge. So I absolutely agree that capitalism has raised people out of poverty. It's produced tremendous technological advantages that I, like all of us in this audience, benefit from hugely, medical care, all those things. I don't think anyone can deny that. But It's also now producing financial crises, unemployment, ecological crises. I think it's starting to hit a certain kind of wall where the idea that the unintended consequences will always be positive. We're starting to realize a lot of the unintended consequences of capitalism are not positive. And so what I say is that we need the ancient virtues to re-enlighten capitalism. It's not that we want to get to destroy capitalism, not at all, but what we need to do is to think, well, why is it also producing these harms, and how can we prevent the production of those?
You have
harms?
A follow-up question. Sir.
I would anytime have these crises than the crisis India faced when we were poor. Anytime. These are much better crises to have than the crisis of not having enough food, starving at night, kids dying of lack of medical care, and everything else that a poor nation faces. Any country in Africa would be glad to have your crisis. Any
country. Wait a minute, though, sir. Wait a minute. If we took it one by one, say, yeah, I'd rather have this crisis. But here's what's happening. I think you'll agree with me. Our individual actions and our national actions, we're destroying our ecosystem. I mean, there was just a report, and they've measured the amount of carbon. They've done some decisive measurement of the amount of carbon in the atmosphere now. There is more carbon in the atmosphere now than at any time in the last three million years. That includes the whole history of the human species, right? And they are utterly alarmed because it may be that we're past the tipping point. So we've got this huge problem that capitalism has produced.
That's right. What we know how to do is a capitalism that raises people out of poverty, and that's an incredibly important thing. I would never deny that. I think everything you say about that is right. But what we don't yet know how to do is a capitalism that doesn't also destroy the planet. And the problem with that is that the ecology of growing tea in Kenya, of growing chocolate in Ghana, that these countries depend on, countries where poor people are dependent on those crops, that's being threatened. The livelihoods of the poor is now being threatened by the byproduct of that capitalism.
Let me just say, capitalism has been reinvented a couple of times. When Adam Smith wrote, there weren't large corporations. A generation or two or later, there were corporations, but they were corporations that were entities created by the state that had the unbridled multinational corporations. That's a further invention. It's not clear it's a good one. Not clear that it's really related to the essence of capitalism or the good things that it's brought. So reinventing capitalism without getting rid of its good parts, if it's not too late, isn't a crazy idea.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Hello, my name is Joanne. I am a physician. I live in Mountain View, California. I appreciate the comment you just made, John, but all aside, I think the biggest problem for our planet is that there are simply too many people, and we can't support any more people, whether it's government, lack of government, socialism, capitalism. We have to go back, I think, to limiting the exponential growth of the population as the first solution.
I think, my two cents, you're absolutely right. There's all kinds of growth, including growth in population, that we're really addicted to. And we got to do something about it. And economists should give us models for prosperity where we have fewer people each year.
I mentioned you could hear mountains.
From APM, American Public Media, and WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace. Here's the host of Marketplace, Kai Ryssdal.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, how are you, man?
Kai, I'm great. Thank you.
All right.
Nice to talk to you. You like riddles, don't you, Kai?
I do.
All right, let me try something out on you then. A listener of ours, a fellow named Ralph Thomas, recently asked us to weigh in on what he calls, quote, the cheapest, most nutritious, and bountiful food that has ever existed in history.
Wow.
He says it's got 390 calories, 23 grams of protein, substantial portions of calcium, iron, and it costs only a buck or two. So, Kai Ryssdal, let me ask you this. What food is Ralph talking about?
It's got to be like tofu or soy or some kind of thing, right?
God, you're smart.
I know.
But you're wrong. But you're wrong also.
You get it all the time, man. What is that?
It's the McDonald's McDouble hamburger.
No, it's not.
This is Ralph's argument. So, and you responded the way a lot of people respond.
Yeah.
We actually brought in a bunch of McDoubles here at WNYC for the staff. And this was definitely not a McDonald's crowd.
Yeah,
check this out.
All right.
Not nutrition at all.
Zero nutrition.
I would say from zero to kale. Technically, there are pickles, so I think they're vegetables.
They're not like real pickles, you know what I mean? It's like McDonald's somehow has engineered their own version of the pickle.
They're, you know, a piece of synecdoche for American mass, bland, synthetic corporatism.
All right, so a couple of things. One, synecdoche, good word. Two, I always did like McDonald's pickles. And number three, come on, that's like the public radio crowd. You heard the lady, zero to kale? Come on.
That is exactly right. And that's kind of my point. The more I thought about Ralph Thomas's question, again, whether the McDouble is the cheapest, most bountiful, and most nutritious food ever, the more I realized that how you answer that question says a lot about how you see the world, not only our food system, but also the economics of it and even social justice.
Whoa, dude, where is this coming from? What?
Well, we set up a little debate on the McDouble between two people. I'd like to play you some of that. One is a health food activist. The other is a sort of scholarly farmer. The activist is Tom Philpott. He's a food columnist for Mother Jones.
Okay.
And he says, sure, the McDouble is cheap, but that's because the price does not factor in all the external costs.
In order to present to us all that $2 burger, you're talking about a vast army of working poor people. And that doesn't even get to the farmer who grew the corn and soy.
Yep.
Okay, so on the other side is Blake Hurst, who is a corn and soy farmer, and he's the president of the Missouri Farm Bureau. Hurst points out that this vast army of working people are also consumers who benefit from low prices.
It's pretty easy to say everyone ought to get paid more. I'm in favor of that, particularly in my own case. But pay is only good in so much as what it can buy. And what you can buy is a McDonald's cheeseburger for just a little over $1 in almost 14,000 restaurants. And that is a good thing.
All right. So value judgments aside, that's the cheap part of this equation. What about the bountiful thing you were talking about?
Well, as Blake Hurst points out, you know, 14,000 Mickey D's in the U.S. alone where you can pop in whenever you need a burger. And this highlights a larger issue that he feels is wildly overlooked.
The biggest unreported story of the last three quarters of a century, this increase in the availability of food for the common person.
And you know, so I'll give him that, right? I mean, that is generally speaking a good thing. You can't turn around nowadays without finding food.
Mm-hmm, that's right. In most places, that's absolutely true. According to the Global Food Security Index that The Economist publishes, the United States is number one in the world, meaning food is very bountiful. Now, that comes with its own problems, of course.
All right, but Dumner, listen, if the point of the original question is that if you had a bunch of people to feed cheaply and you wanted to feed them, you know, at least reasonably well, what would you give them? What's the answer?
Well, here's Tom Philpott's very Mother Jonesy idea.
You can get a pound of brown rice, organic, and a pound of red lentils for about $2 each. And a serving size, say a cup of each of those things, would be about 75 cents.
Okay, so that's that. And here's how Blake Hurst, the farmer, sees things.
Okay.
Yeah, but I rest my case. I'm sorry. There is no amount of marketing that is going to make me prefer brown rice and lentils over a McDonald's cheeseburger.
All right, well, so maybe he's got a point. Who won the debate, though, dude?
I'll let your listeners decide. You know, as you see, people have very strong opinions about the stuff, fact-based or otherwise. In my own home, I've got one kid who loves McDonald's and another who will not go anywhere near it. But that's how it kind of goes with these things. So I guess I've got to call Tom Philpott back to get some nice recipes for lentils and rice. I got to feed my daughter.
Good luck on that one, man. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. Dubner, we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me, Guy.
It's that time of year. Time to register at Henry Ford Community College for the 2013 fall semester. Most of the classes that you will take at Henry Ford Community College will transfer to major four-year institutions in the area. Also, HFCC has some of the lowest tuition rates around. First-time students can go to the Welcome Center on campus. call 800-585-HFCC or go to the web at www.hfcc.edu for more information. Fall semester starts August 22nd, so register today to get the best choice for classes. See you there. Green jobs are here to stay. Why not go green with a degree in alternative energy here at Henry Ford Community College? Students will acquire knowledge in advanced fuel sources and the practice of alternative energy in the world. For more information on the alternative energy program, please contact HFCC's Technology Division by calling 313-317-9816 or by going to hfcc.edu/programs.
Henry Ford Community College has a medical practice clinical management degree program that will prepare you for a rewarding career in the exciting field of healthcare. You can earn a certificate as a medical office assistant or a two-year degree in medical office management. For more information, give us a call at 800-585-HFCC.
Think you have what it takes? We do. Henry Ford Community College. Visit us online at hfcc.edu.
Choice on 89.3 is blues, but the impact is on all of us. Hi, I'm Anderson Coleman, inviting you to Blues with a Feeling. Join me on WHFR.FM Saturdays from 4 to 6 p.m. on the only station making waves.
Dearborn is celebrating its 34th annual Homecoming Festival this August 2nd, 3rd, and 4th in West Dearborn at Ford Field Park, 22051 Cherry Hill. Come and experience the live music, great food, family activities, a carnival, and not to mention a spectacular firework display on Saturday and Sunday night. So make your way back home this August 2nd, 3rd, and 4th for the 34th annual Homecoming Festival in West Dearborn at Ford Field Park, 22051 Cherry Hill.
WHFR, the station making waves, proudly presents The Best of Broadway, a program featuring the best of American musical theater. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Joe, your host. We've taken care of your tickets. Now let me...
You know, this virtual reality software has really gotten pretty sophisticated.
I know, it looks like you're really traveling through that rainforest.
Well, you can go anywhere, not just the rainforest. You can go to the tops of the trees and look around there. You could sail around the bottom of the ocean.
But it seems like a lot of these tours are limited to Earth or to the oceans on Earth. Can you go into the solar system?
Well, some of them do, and really you can do it now because we have data about what the solar system looks like, you know, thanks to 50 years of spacecraft. So sure, yeah, virtual reality tour of the solar system.
I bet we could come up with our own tour of the solar system, but we could make it more specific, like hunt for life through the solar system. Let's say we did that. Where would you start?
Well, I'd go to those places that are suspected of having liquids, in particular water, right? NASA's mantra, to follow the water in the solar system. I mean, there's possibly a great deal more water than you imagine.
Speaking of imagination, many of these exotic outposts have tickled the imagination of writers long before we had the engineering wizardry to visit them. So let's bring someone else on our tour.
I'm Robert J. Sawyer, a Hugo Award-winning science fiction writer.
Great. He knows the kinds of alien science fiction writers have created to populate the locales we're going to go visit. So we can just see how prescient these writers really were. I mean, how does sci-fi jibe with the science? I'm Seth Shostak.
I'm Molly Bentley. This is Big Picture Science.
Okay, well, let's do this in a logical fashion. We'll begin with the closest planet that's received the most attention from scientists and science fiction writers is, of course, our rusty, dusty pal, Mars. Rovers have spent years crawling the Martian surface. Another explorer, the Mars Science Laboratory, is on its way there now to join the other half dozen or so pieces of rolling hardware that have wandered the fourth rock from the sun.
Mars has also been a favorite destination for imaginative minds.
Rob, Mars has always been a favorite locale for science fiction writers. How far back does Martian science fiction go?
Well, in terms of any kind of serious treatment, it goes back to H.G. Wells and The War of the Worlds, which was a 1902 novel. So we're talking 110 years now that science fiction writers have really been, they were inspired by Schiaparelli and the notion that there might be canals, channels of water on the surface of Mars. And Wells was the first one to kind of pick up a piece of science and go with that to portray in his case, a dying civilization, which was very much, of course, what Percival Lowell, who mistranslated canale to canals, thought he was seeing on the surface of Mars. The problem with Wells's, and I'll say also the problem with Percival Lowell's interpretation, is it looks at the ecosystem on Mars as being ill-adapted for the conditions on Mars. You have people, in Wells's terms, intellects vast, cool, and unsympathetic, looking across the gulf of space at our verdant planet, Earth, green, blue, water, and deciding, as he says, to slowly and surely draw their plans against us. Come 1934, we're talking three decades later, a great writer, tragically, his life was cut short, Stanley G. Weinbaum wrote the quintessential Mars story, and it was called A Martian Odyssey, and it's literally just that, a marooned astronaut trekking across the surface of Mars. But he built a whole ecology that was suitably, ideally adapted for the dry, desert-like conditions on Mars. Instead of them railing against it, they were absolutely adapted, which is, of course, the lesson that Darwin taught us, that life adapts to the environment. It doesn't struggle against that.
So you have Weinbaum, you have H.G. Wells, but you had others. I mean, you had Edgar Rice Burroughs, you had the Martian Chronicles. Mars was definitely our favorite inhabited planet. Any particular reason for that?
Well, yeah, there are a couple of reasons. Of course, it's the second closest planet to Earth. Venus is the closer, or can get closer than Mars does. And Mars, through the telescope, seemed to have geography, and it seemed to have seasonal changes in its surface markings. Now, we hoped originally, of course, that these were the ebbing and flowing of forests or foliage coming and going with the spring and dying off in the winter. Didn't turn out to be the case, but it certainly sparked the imagination. The fact that it was nearby, Venus, as you know, is completely shrouded in cloud. Even to the present day, nobody on Earth has ever optically from Earth seen the surface of Venus. So it was a mystery. But Mars seemed to have geography. It seemed to have mountains and valleys, and as we learned later, huge volcanoes and huge the Mariner's Valley, huge rift valleys and so forth that were incredibly provocative to writers of fiction.
Okay, so Mars has the geography and the proximity to tickle the imagination of writers, but let's see what science has to say. Now, we started this by following the water. Mars doesn't seem to have liquid water on its surface, so why land here?
Well, it's true. The landscapes of Mars are cold, they're dry, they're covered with sand, pretty unfriendly for life, so it would seem. But they may have had surface liquid water once upon a time.
Once upon a time means?
Billions of years ago. At least that's what we think. But water's not all you need. If you're a fan of breathing, you'll also need an atmosphere.
I'm a big fan of breathing. But Mars doesn't have a very thick atmosphere, so it wouldn't be the destination to go if you do like to breathe. But the clue as to why Mars doesn't have much of an atmosphere comes from some pretty attractive research on the magnetic field of the planet.
And why it doesn't have one. So space and planetary scientist Rob Lillis wants to know why. His team is preparing to send a mission to Mars called MAVEN to investigate why Mars doesn't have the magnetic personality of its planetary buddy, Earth.
Okay, well, Mars does not have a magnetic field in the same way that the Earth does. Mars does not have what we scientists call a magnetohydrodynamic dynamo. That just means it doesn't have a large-scale global magnetic field generated by the motions of liquid iron in its core.
Okay, but then the question is, did Mars ever have a magnetic field, and why does that matter?
Okay, well, Mars definitely did have one of these large-scale global magnetic fields a long time ago. So how do we know that? Well, Mars may not have a global magnetic field, but Mars has some extremely magnetic crust. Certain regions of Mars have huge areas, hundreds of kilometers by hundreds of kilometers wide and tens of kilometers thick, all magnetized in the same direction. And so this actually causes some pretty strong magnetic fields.
The NASA mantra is follow the water. Evidence seems to be in that Mars was once a wet world, but it isn't any longer. And I understand that the fact that it's no longer wet, it is now dry, and this mystery of what happened to its magnetic field may be intertwined.
As you say, we have lots and lots of evidence that Mars was indeed wet. Mars had large areas of standing liquid water, lakes, rivers, possibly oceans. Now, for liquid water to be stable on the surface of a planet, you need a much thicker atmosphere than Mars currently possesses. If you were to pour out a glass of water on the surface of Mars right now, it would evaporate almost instantly. In fact, it would actually boil because the pressure is so low, there just isn't enough atmosphere to keep it stable like there is here on Earth. So the question is, why did Mars lose its atmosphere and where did it go? This is where the magnetic field comes in. So when you have a global magnetic field, it acts as a shield between the particles, the charged particles of the solar wind and the planet's atmosphere. So if you have a magnetic field, that's a protective bubble in which the atmosphere can live. If you get rid of that magnetic field, now there are many other ways for the solar wind to erode and to strip away the upper atmosphere, and ultimately, if you have enough time, large amounts of the atmosphere, we estimate that Mars may have lost 95% of its original atmosphere. And the presence or absence after a certain time of the magnetic field may have hastened that.
But then isn't the big question is, what happened to the magnetic field? And how does a planet's magnetic field just go away?
Well, the most important quantity for whether or not a planet has a magnetic field is whether the liquid iron in its outer core can churn fast enough, can sort of turn over fast enough. We use the word convection to describe the sort of churning motion. Now, the churning motion has to have a source of energy for it. On the Earth, it's the fact that we have an inner core and an outer core, and the outer core is slowly shrinking as the liquid closest to the inner core turns into a solid. When it turns into a solid, that releases heat. That heat keeps the outer core of the Earth churning fast enough to keep our magnetic field going. That heat also has to have somewhere to go. Now, on Earth, we have plate tectonics, which is what causes earthquakes and volcanoes. Plate tectonics allow hot stuff to come up and cold stuff to go down, meaning plate tectonics on Earth allows our core a way to lose its heat more easily. Mars does not have plate tectonics. Mars has a single, what's called a stagnant lid, and so Mars does not have an easy way to lose heat from its core. So Mars's core, because of that, cannot churn sufficiently fast enough to create a magnetic field.
Mars right now does have water there in the form of ice, but with the absence of flowing liquid water on Mars and the absence of an atmosphere and the absence of a magnetic field, what does that suggest about the presence of life on the planet, whether or not there's life, even microbial life on the planet today, or if there ever was life?
Well, there could be life on the planet today. You know, pretty much anywhere north of, I believe, about 35 degrees north and south latitude, there are huge amounts of ice trapped right under the surface. So there's a very large reservoir of water on Mars. It's just that it's currently mostly in a solid form. However, there's plenty of evidence that there are places on Mars where, when just the right solar conditions occur, that it can actually go just above the freezing temperature of water, and you can actually get small amounts of sort of seeping liquid water. These are the so-called gullies. Now, the reason this is important for the life question is because you don't have to go terribly far underground to find places where episodically you can still have liquid water on Mars. What's also important about being underground is that you are protected from the radiation on the surface of Mars. So there could be areas of Mars where you just go a few meters down and you could, in theory, have all the ingredients necessary to sustain simple microbial life.
This would be subterranean life, if there is life on Mars, and it can exist underground, protected from radiation, with water, and it doesn't need the planet to have a magnetic field, at least the kind of life that we're talking about.
That's right. And in fact, on Earth, it's not the magnetic field per se that protects us from the radiation. It's the atmosphere protects us from the radiation. The magnetic field protects the atmosphere. On Mars, you have neither a very thick atmosphere nor a magnetic field, but it's the lack of atmosphere, or the very thin atmosphere, I should say, that results in a very harsh surface radiation environment. Many of the questions surrounding where the atmosphere of Mars has gone and the processes by which the atmosphere has disappeared will be answered by the upcoming MAVEN mission. That's M-A-V-E-N. That stands for Mars Atmosphere Volatile Evolution Mission, launching in November 2013.
Rob, thank you very much.
No worries. Thanks a million.
Robert Lillis is a space and planetary scientist at the Space Sciences Laboratory at the University of California in Berkeley. Well, Rob Sawyer, from a science fiction point of view, would you say that Mars is kind of passé these days? I mean, now that we know it doesn't quite look as attractive to life as we thought it did 50 or maybe even 80 years ago?
Yeah, this is the thing. Of course, when we finally got there with Mariner in the 60s and Viking in the 70s, and we discovered what we had not anticipated, a planet pelted, covered with craters, a planet that looked dead and ancient, an ancient surface instead of a tectonically or geologically active surface, suddenly we all kind of moved away from that. My great friend Kim Stanley Robinson and went and ran with that and wrote a trilogy, Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars, about the terraforming of Mars, taking as two assumptions, one, that it was a wasteland, and two, that it was sterile, that there was no life there. What we found in the last couple of years, though, is a little bit of a resurgence, and there are more and more people starting to think that maybe there, if there isn't extant life on Mars, we may at least find fossil evidence of life, and maybe even there is possibilities. We keep finding intriguing signs of water on Mars, recent erosional activity on the surface of Mars that is getting my colleagues and myself very excited again.
Okay, Rob, hold on. We'll come back to you as we move a little farther out. Next stop, past the asteroid belt, about 800 million miles to the gas giant Jupiter, big enough to hold 1,000 Earths. Jupiter weighs as much as all the other planets put together.
And do you know what that is?
Not off the top of my head, but it's a lot.
What would the formula be, just if you had to write it as an equation?
Well, I'd just take 4/3 pi r cubed for, something the size of Jupiter and multiply it by 1 gram per cc, and you get in the ballpark anyhow.
Is that true, or are you spitting out numbers?
I'm telling you the truth. Okay. Tammy tells you true. All right, Rob, now there have been science fiction stories made about this place. Seems sort of unappealing, covered with methane and ammonia and so forth. So what is it that drew science fiction to Jupiter?
Well, Jupiter, of course, is the king of the planets. It's the largest of the 8 planets in our solar system. It's almost a failed star, gigantic ball of gas. And the gases it's made of, methane, ammonia, and so forth, are the primordial gases that Earth's original atmosphere was made of. So that's very appealing. There's complex chemistry going on in the atmosphere. And everybody who, the very first science fiction work was Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. How was matter reanimated in Frankenstein? Electricity, lightning bolts. Well, the atmosphere of Jupiter is very electrically active. So you've got this primordial soup, you've got electricity constantly being pumped into it, you've got something that's almost a star in its own right. It begs the question of whether or not perhaps complex organic life chemistry ever arose in its atmosphere. And Sir Arthur C. Clarke, my all-time favorite science fiction writer, explored this in 1971 in a wonderful novella called A Meeting with Medusa. Medusa, of course, being another name for the jellyfish. And he proposed that mile in diameter, jellyfish-like creatures float in this methane atmosphere of Jupiter, and that perhaps they might be extant till this present day. Carl Sagan, the great astronomer, picked up on this very concept and actually adopted it and used it in one of the episodes of his later science series, Cosmos, on PBS. So this was really taken quite seriously for a time. We haven't been to Jupiter yet. We don't know for sure. But it's a very intriguing notion that this primordial soup and these electric sparks might, in fact, give rise to life.
Thanks, Rob. While science fiction writers like to imagine jellyfish floating around this supersized planet, it's what's orbiting it that intrigues scientists. Jupiter has more than 5 dozen moons.
And we'll find out what that means for water and for life in a moment. Is the universe rife with life? It's Big Picture Science.
This year's homecoming will be held August 2nd through August 4th. Join us at the WHFR booth, where we will have great items for sale, such as impossible to find CDs, WHFR hats, t-shirts, and other items. Speak with your favorite DJs and experience the magic of radio as we broadcast live. Find us August 2nd through August 4th at the Dearborn Homecoming.
If you want to change the world, then you have to change yourself. One of the best places in the Metro Detroit area to improve your life is Henry Ford Community College. Henry Ford Community College offers dozens of degree and certificate programs, plus the opportunity to network with your peers and potential employers. Taking classes at Henry Ford Community College gives you the freedom to take your own career path and opens up an infinite number of career possibilities. Additionally, day and evening classes allow you the flexibility of building a schedule tailored to your busy lifestyle. So change the world, change yourself at Henry Ford Community College. For more information on admittance and financial aid and class schedules, call the Henry Ford Community College toll-free number at 1-800-585-HFCC. Again, that's 1-800-585-HFCC.
WHFR, the station making waves, proudly presents The Best of Broadway, a program featuring the best of American musical theater. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Joe, your host. We've taken care of your tickets. Now let me escort you through 2 hours of enjoyment of The Best of Broadway. And today we are going to feature the play Kismet. This is featuring Doretta Morrow, Richard Kiley, Henry Calvin, Joan Diener. The play has an interesting history. It was first seen in New York on December 25th, 1911, starring Otis Skinner. Mr. Skinner also appeared in the film version in 1930. In 1942, another film version was made starring Ronald Coleman and Marlena Dietrich. The latter, covered with gold